Mr. Sponge's Sporting Tour by R.S. Surtees. Chapter 2. Mr. Benjamin Buckram. Having dressed and sufficiently described our hero to enable our readers to form a general idea of the man, we have now to request them to return to the day of our introduction. Mr. Sponge had gone along Oxford Street at a somewhat improved pace to his usual wont, had paused for a shorter period in the bus-perplexed circus, and pulled up seldomer than usual between the circus and the limits of his stroll. Behold him now at the Edgware Road end, eyeing the buses with a wanting-a-ride-like air, instead of the contemptuous sneer he generally adopts toward those uncouth productions. Red, green-blue, drab, cinnamon color, passed and crossed, and jostled, and stopped, and blocked, and the cads telegraphed and winked and nodded and smiled and slanged, but Mr. Sponge regarded them not. He had a sort of bus panorama in his head, knew the run of them all, whence they started, whence they stopped, where they watered, where they changed, and, wonderful to relate, had never been entrapped into a sixpenny fare when he meant to take a threepenny one. In cab and bus geography, there is not a more learned man in London. Mark him as he stands at the corner. He sees what he wants. It's the checkered one with the red and blue wheels that the Bayswater ones have got between them, and that the St. John's Wood and the two Western Railway ones are trying to get into trouble by crossing. What a row! How the ruffians whip and stamp and storm and all but pick each other's horses' teeth with their poles! How the cads gesticulate, and the passengers imprecate. Now the bonnets are out of the windows, and the row increases. Six coachmen cutting and storming, six cads sawing the air, 16 ladies in flowers screaming, 26 sturdy passengers swearing they will find them all, and Mr. Sponge is the only cool person in the scene. He doesn't rush into the throng and jump in, for fear the bus should extricate itself and drive on without him. He doesn't make confusion worse, confounded, by intimating his behest. He doesn't soil his bright boots by stepping off the curbstone, but, quietly waiting the evaporation of the steam and the disentanglement of the vehicles, by the smallest possible sign in the world, given at the opportune moment, and a steady adhesion to the flags, the bus is obliged either to come to or lose the fare, and he steps quietly in, and squeezes along to the far end, as though intent on going the whole hog of the journey. Away they rumble up the Edgware Road, the gradual emergence from the brick and mortar of London being marked as well by the telling out of passengers as by the increasing distances between the houses. First it is all close huddle with both. Austere iron railings guard the subterranean kitchen areas, and austere looks indicate a desire on the part of the passengers to guard their own pockets. Gradually, little gardens usurp the places of the cramped areas, and with their humanizing appearance, softer looks assume the place of frowning anti-swell mob ones. Presently, a glimpse of green country or of distant hills may be caught between the wider space of the houses, and frequent settings down increase the space between the passengers. Gradually, conservatories appear, and conversation strikes up. Then come the exclusiveness of villas, some detached and others running out at last into real, pure green fields, studded with trees and picturesque pothouses, before one of which latter, a sudden wheel round and a jerk, announces the journey done. The last passenger, if there is one, is then unceremoniously turned loose upon the country. Our readers will have the kindness to suppose our hero, Mr. Sponge, shot out of an omnibus at the sign of the Cat and Compasses in the full rurality of grass country, sprinkled with fallows and turnip fields. We should state that this unwonted journey was a desire to pay a visit to Mr. Benjamin Buckram, the horse dealer's farm at Scampley, distant some mile and a half from where he was set down, a space that he now purposed traveling on foot. Mr. Benjamin Buckram was a small horse dealer, small at least when he was buying, though great when he was selling. It would do a youngster good to see Ben filling the two capacities. He dealt in second hand, that is to say, past mark-of-mouth horses. But on the present occasion, Mr. Sponge sought his services in the capacity of a letter rather than a seller of horses. Mr. Sponge wanted to job a couple of plausible-looking horses with the option of buying them, provided he, Mr. Sponge, could sell them for more than he would have to give Mr. Buckram, exclusive of the hire. Mr. Buckram's job price, we should say, was as near £12 a month, containing 28 days, as he could screw, the hirer, of course, keeping the animals. Scampley is one of those pretty little suburban farms, peculiar to the north and northwest side of London. Farms varying from 50 to 100 acres of well-manured, gravelly soil, each farm with its picturesque little buildings, consisting of small, honeysuckled, rose-entwined, bricked houses, with small, flat, pan-tiled roofs, and lattice windows, and hard by, a large haystack, three times the size of the house, or a desolate barn, half as big as all the rest of the buildings. From the smallness of the holdings, the farmhouses are dotted about as thickly, and at such varying distances from the roads, as to look like inferior villas, falling out of rank. Most of them have a half-smart, half-seedy sort of look. The rustics who cultivate them, or rather look after them, are neither exactly town nor country. They have the clownish dress and boorish gait of the regular chaws, with a good deal of the quick, suspicious, sour sauciness of the low London resident. If you can get an answer from them at all, it is generally delivered in such a way as to show that the answerer thinks you are what they call chaffing them, asking them what you know. These farms serve the double purpose of purveyors to the London stables and hospitals for sick, overworked, or unsaleable horses. All the great job masters and horse dealers have these retreats in the country, and the smaller ones pretend to have, from whence, in due course, they can draw any sort of animal a customer may want, just as little cellarless wine merchants can get you any sort of wine from real establishments, if you only give them time. There was a good deal of mystery about Scampley. It was sometimes in the hands of Mr. Benjamin Buckram, sometimes in the hands of his assignees, sometimes in those of his cousin, Abraham Brown, and sometimes John Doe and Richard Rowe were the occupants of it. Mr. Benjamin Buckram, though very far from being one, had the advantage of looking like a respectable man. There was a certain plump, well-fed rosiness about him, which, aided by a bright-colored dress, joined to a continual fumble in the pockets of his drab trousers, gave him the air of a well-to-do-in-the-world sort of man. Moreover, he sported a velvet collar to his blue coat, a more imposing ornament than it appears at first sight. To be sure, there are two sorts of velvet collars, the legitimate velvet collar commencing with the coat, and the adopted velvet collar, put on when the cloth one gets shabby. Buckram's was always the legitimate velvet collar, new from the first, and we really believe a permanent velvet collar, adhered to in storm and in sunshine, has a very money-making impression on the world. It shows a spirit superior to feelings of paltry economy, and we think a person would be much more excusable for being victimized by a man with a good velvet collar to his coat than by one exhibiting that spurious sign of gentility, a horse and gig. The reader will now have the kindness to consider Mr. Sponge arriving at Scampley. "Ah, Mr. Sponge!" exclaimed Mr. Buckram, who, having seen our friend advancing up the little twisting approach from the road to his house, through a little square window almost blinded with Irish ivy, out of which he was in the habit of contemplating the arrival of his occasional lodgers, Doe and Roe. "Ah, Mr. Sponge!" exclaimed he with well-assumed gaiety. "You should have been here yesterday. Sent away two sich asses, perfect hunters, the wery best I do think I ever saw in my life. Either would have been the wery oss from your money. But come in, Mr. Sponge, sir, come in," continued he, backing himself through a little sentry box of a green portico, to a narrow passage which branched off into little rooms on either side. As Buckram made this retrograde movement, he gave a gentle pull to the wooden handle of an old-fashioned wire bell pull in the midst of buggy, four-in-hand, and other whips hanging in the entrance, a touch that was acknowledged by a single tinkle of the bell in the stable yard. They then entered the little room on the right, whose walls were decorated with various sporting prints, chiefly illustrative of steeplechases, with here and there a stunted fox brush tossing about as a duster. The ill-ventilated room reeked with the effluvia of stale smoke, and the faded green baize of a little round table in the center was covered with filbert shells and empty ale glasses. The whole furniture of the room wasn't worth 5 pounds. Mr. Sponge, being now on the dealing tack, commenced in the poverty-stricken strain adapted to the occasion. Having deposited his hat on the floor, taken his left leg up to nurse, and given his hair a backward rub with his right hand, he thus commenced. "Now, Buckram," said he, "I'll tell you how it is. I'm deuced hard up, regularly in Short's Gardens. I lost 1,800 on the Derby, and 7 on the Ledger, the best part of my year's income, indeed. And I just want to hire 2 or 3 horses for the season, with the option of buying if I like. And if you supply me well, I may be the means of bringing grist to your mill, you twig, eh?" "Well, Mr. Sponge," replied Buckram, sliding several consecutive half-crowns down the inclined plane of his pocket, "well, Mr. Sponge, I shall be happy to do my best for you. I wish you'd come yesterday, though, as I said before. I just had 2 of the neatest nags, a bay and a grey. Not that colour makes any matter to a judge like you. There's no sound a saying that a good ass is not never of a bad colour. Only to a young gemman, you know, it's well to have 'em smart. And the ticket, in short. Howsomever, I must do the best I can for you. And if there's nothing in that tickles your fancy, why, you must give me a few days to see if I can arrange an exchange with some other gent. But the present is like to be a wary hag of waiting season. Had more applications for asses nor ever I remembers. And I've been a dealer now, man and boy, turned of 38 years. But young gents is whimsical, and it was a young'un what got these, and there's no saying but he mayn't like them. Indeed, one's rather difficult to ride, that's to say the grey, the neatest of the two, and he may come back, and if so, you shall have him, and a safer, sweeter ass was never seen, or one more like to do credit to a gent. But you knows what a ass is, Mr. Sponge, and can do justice to me, and I should like to put summat good into your hands. That I should." With conversation, or rather with balderdash such as this, Mr. Buckram beguiled the few minutes necessary for removing the bandages, hiding the bottles, and stirring up the cripples about to be examined. And the heavy flap of the coach-house door announcing that all was ready, he forthwith led the way through a door in a brick wall into a little 3 sides of a square yard, formed of stables and loose boxes, with a dilapidated dovecot above a pump in the center. Mr. Buckram, not growing corn, could afford to keep pigeons. End of chapter 2.